Welcome, I'm Holly Kernan, and this is Your Call. What is the cost of free information? Do we need to change the way that we think about digital technology in order to save our economy? Jaron Lanier argues that digital information is really just people in disguise, and we need to put people back at the center of this new economy. His new book, Who Owns the Future, explores the idea that digital networks are destroying the middle class because as digital technologies and social media networks get smarter, faster, and more comprehensive, the people who make the networks valuable in the first place, that's us, are the ones who are losing out. Lanier writes, we're already seeing self-driving vehicles that will eventually put taxi and truck drivers out of work. Automated systems have already been demonstrated that can do approximately what legal researchers, pharmacists, and biology researchers do. But if we make information free, what kinds of jobs can survive in the new economy, the information economy? Lanier reluctantly admits, we can survive if we destroy the middle classes of musicians, journalists, and photographers. What is not survivable is the additional destruction of the middle classes in transportation, manufacturing, energy, office work, education, and healthcare. But don't despair. Jaron Lanier has many ideas about how we can come together and change the architecture of digital technology, and together we can save the middle class. Are you ready to do that with me and Jaron Lanier today? Hi, Jaron.
Hey.
Have I given you a little too much to do?
No, it's great. I wish the audience could see you because you're very visually entertaining when you do these introductions.
Thank you. Jaron Lanier has been called the father of virtual reality. He's a scientist and a musician. He brought an instrument here to the studio with us, and we'll have him play a little of that. He's best known for his work in virtual reality research. He's worked in academia and in the private sector, helping create companies that were eventually acquired by Oracle, Adobe, and Google. Lanier also writes orchestral music, and he's currently working on a project with Microsoft Research, and he says that he is part of the problem that he's trying to address. He's the author of the bestseller, You Are Not a Gadget, and the most recent book, Who Owns the Future? Welcome to Your Call.
Well, it is always delightful to be here.
And so you write, sometimes you screw up. I was part of the first generation of cyberculture that articulated the ideals of making information free, of open file sharing, and of volunteerism in online life. We now know enough based on real-world results to realize that we have to move on and find better ideas. So first, I'm going to throw a two-parter at you. Why did you advocate for free information then, and what changed your mind now?
Well, you know, the reason I advocated for it then is the reason that so many people still do, which is that in history, we've again and again see people who abuse power controlling information in order to maintain their ability to abuse power. So every dictator, one of the first things they do is attempt to control the press, right? And so throughout history, we've seen this. So it was an incredibly natural response to an overwhelming pattern in history to say, okay, we're going to bust this open. If we have digital networks that allow information to be shared freely, that should counteract the tendency of people to be able to accumulate power in a corrupt way. And it makes sense. And I was terribly passionate about it starting over 3 decades ago. And what changed my mind about it wasn't any change in my ideals or in the logic. It's just looking at the results. And so, you know, in science, once in a while, you have an idea that just seems great. But then when you do the test in the lab, you discover that maybe it doesn't work. And I feel that that's kind of what happened here, that the idea sounded great, still sounds great, but it hasn't panned out. And the way it hasn't panned out is really simple to me. When networking finally became available to the world, instead of in a decrease in concentration of wealth and power, we saw an increase in concentration of wealth and power. Since the dawn of widespread digital networking, we've seen the financial sector increase like crazy. We've seen a financial recovery that only benefits the very top little tip of society, which I'm happy to be part of, but it's not the society I want to live in. So I don't think it's in my interest to be that kind of elite. You know, I actually think all of us are undermining ourselves when we create a society like that. And when I look at what's happened, at the way that influence and power have become concentrated in every one of these clumps, it used to be if you opened up the clump and looked inside, you found an oil field or a railroad line. Now you find a big computer. that's connected to the network.
So explain this for us. So that's what you talk about, is that this high-powered networking and you talk about these siren servers, these servers that have all of our information, but that's collected from tiny bits of data that you and I have, maybe a translation that I did online or the data about where I shop, et cetera, that all of this information is concentrated in the hands of the few.
Right. So the example you brought up of translating is one that I use early in the book. So here's how that works. We like to talk about big computers online as if they're these magic electronic brains that can do things that used to only be doable by people. So you can upload an article in English and it comes back in Spanish. Google or Microsoft can do that, or IBM. And the way we talk about it is, oh, isn't it great? We have this free service from this magic electronic brain. But that's completely false. The way it actually works is tons of real translations by real people are gathered and pattern matched against your new text, and then a pastiche or a mashup of that is created, and that's your translation. So the thing is, anytime there's a big electronic brain online, what's really going on is there's a crowd of real people behind the curtain who are erased, who we pretend aren't there. They're made anonymous. We turn them into fodder. We're not dealing with them as real people. And the problem with that pattern is it creates this immediate feeling of a treat, but in the long term, it gradually reduces employment and security options for all of us, because eventually it'll affect everything everybody does.
So I feel like I'm getting this treat, right? I'm putting in a translation and, oh, this magic happens that I'm getting this thing for free, right? That I mm-hmm. want a Spanish translation or a Mandarin translation of something. I get it. But that is mining the work of real people who are no longer being paid for it.
Right. Just like when somebody copies your program and moves it around on BitTorrent or something, and somebody else gets to place an ad and make money off it, you're being very gradually, incrementally disenfranchised from your own future options. Now it's a subtle thing because I already know a lot of my friends in the field, because I was one of them for so many years. They'll say, wait. Everybody's getting benefits from that. It's just that you're not getting money. You're getting informal benefits. And so the informal benefit is you get the free translation, you get to promote yourself in social media, all this stuff. But informal benefits are precisely what the developing world is trying to crawl out from under. Informal benefits mean that you have to constantly be promoting yourself. You have to sing for your supper for every meal. For instance, if you're a musician, you have to live gig. You can never afford to be sick. You can't have kids. You can't grow old. Formal benefits.
No more growing old. We're going to.
That's right. We're all going to be
do kids. Away with that.
That's right. And so the problem is that if you say that only the people with the big computers get the formal benefits and everybody else gets informal benefits, you're creating a terrible class divide, and you're asking people not to be biological. Only the people who are born rich then can enjoy fulfilling, you know, lives that are secure.
Well, so let's delve into a little bit more, which seems to be the center of your book, which is that the way that we have created the architecture of this new digital economy is destroying the middle class, and mm-hmm. what you have two kind of economic models. One is the bell curve, where there's lots of people in the middle, and the other is this kind of feudal kind of system, the American Idol or the winner-take-all system, which is what you say we've actually created in this new digital economy that we're just starting to see the effects of, but that's where we're going unless we change this.
Right. So I have a lot of friends who are libertarians and believe government's always the problem and markets are always the solution. And I have even more friends who believe the reverse, that we should distrust markets and capitalism, and what we should try to do is improve how we work together to solve problems, or social processes or government. And let's leave that aside, because either way, no matter what you believe, it only works if there's a strong middle class. Or maybe you hate the term middle class. Maybe to you, the middle class means bourgeois, parental, boredom or something. Fine. The point is, there have to be a bunch of people in the middle of the society who can collectively outspend any elite tip.
For capitalism to work.
For either, because capitalism only works if they're customers. So without that strong middle class, you can't even have a market. And obviously, democracy becomes corrupted if an aristocracy becomes too powerful. That's always the problem of how democracy can fail. And I'm worried about America for that right now, by the way. So you need this strong center. So what we've been doing with digital networks is we've been using digital networks to calculate the very most optimal, most efficient way to do something from the point of view of whoever owns the biggest computer on the network. Right. And this was...
And that's who's getting rich, you say. It's whoever's able to kind of... harness this networking and digital data mining.
The big mistake that my friends and I made, in my view, decades ago, was that we assumed if everybody shared on a network, everyone would benefit equally. But even if you say people are created equal, the problem is that computers are not created equal. So on an open network where everybody's sharing information, whoever has the biggest computer will be able to outcompute everybody else. They'll be able to try to create a perfect insurance company where they can compute who will need insurance and who won't, to try to create this perfect scheme where they get the benefit, everyone else takes the risk. They'll be able to try to create the perfect financial scheme where they can bundle weird derived assets. They get the benefit, everyone else takes the risk.
Can we delve into that? A little bit more, because you really give the example of the 2008 crash, and you say that finance got networked in the wrong way. So maybe try and explain that to everybody who's listening right now, and myself included, because I didn't fully understand that.
Well, this stuff does get a little subtle sometimes, and my apologies if I'm trying to learn to... You know, it's funny, after writing the book, I feel like now I've sort of learned to talk about it a little bit. It does take a while to understand a new perspective, even for the person who has it. But
it's a wonderful book, actually. I really, really enjoy it, and I don't know very much about this, so it was easy to read.
Okay, you know, what I have found is the easiest way to explain it is using an example from physics, which I know will probably scare a lot of people, but you probably know there can't be a perpetual motion machine. And the reason there can't be is any perpetual motion machine would turn out to be just like this thing called Maxwell's demon, which is this imaginary creature who just opens a little door to let hot molecules go one way and cold molecules the other way between two chambers. And if you have the hot and cold separated, then you can let them run together to run a turbine. Then you let the little demon just do it again and again, and you have perpetual motion. And the reason you can't is that the energy and effort to separate those molecules into hot and cold actually is worse than whatever benefit you'd gain. All right, so that's in a nutshell how thermodynamics works. I've just given you a basic lesson.
Thank you. Okay, yay. Physics 101 for Holly.
So there's
let me just remind everybody, you're listening to Your Call. I'm Holly Kernan, and I'm speaking with Jaron Lanier, the father of virtual reality. His new book is Who Owns the Future? And it's really about this new digital economy that we've created. And what Jaron argues is that the architecture that we have created is actually destroying the middle class, and we need to do something to change that equation. And he's talking to us about kind of how we got here and what we might do to change this. So go ahead. We're at the 2008 financial crash.
Right. And I just gave you a basic lesson in thermodynamics and physics, which is also no free lunch. All right. So now if you happen to find yourself with the biggest computer in a network, what happens to you naturally, even if you're good-natured and a really nice person, is you try to be Maxwell's demon. You try to say, oh, I'm going to try to calculate the world to my benefit. I'm going to take all the people who are going to need my insurance and put them to one side, and all the people who won't need my insurance to the other, and only insure those who don't. And that's American healthcare. That's what big computation did to insurance. It's pretending to...
So we'll give insurance to the people who are not going to get sick or have less chance of getting sick.
Right. When you have a big computer, it gives you the illusion that you can create the perfect business because you can calculate all the risk away. So this happened with long-term capital and with Enron, and then it happened with mortgages. It's about to happen with student loans and with carbon credits and with all kinds of other things. It'll keep on happening as long as people with the biggest computers can get information about everybody else for free. The problem with free information is that it hyper empowers whoever has the biggest computer on a network. That's the core issue. And I'm oversimplifying it a little bit, and I know that, but I need to be able to oversimplify it a bit just to get the idea out, because it's not the way things are usually looked at. But I think it is actually the most useful way to look at our present circumstances.
All right, and we'll get more into this in just a moment. Again, my guest is Jaron Lanier. His book is Who Owns the Future? And I'm going to take this opportunity to invite our listeners to join this conversation. And if you work in digital technology, we would love to hear from you. What do you think of what Jaron is saying about who owns the future, and whether or not the way that we've created this digital architecture is ultimately going to be detrimental for the large majority of our society? Our number is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also send us an email to feedback at yourcallradio.com. www.freeinformation.org. Do you think that you should be compensated for the information you share through online social networks? Should we have an opt-out instead of an opt-in instead of an opt-out system for data? And if you're part of the industries that Jaron Lanier says are dwindling as a result of digital technology, music recording, photography, journalism, for example, what do you think can be done to save your line of work? Or is that really the question we should be asking right now? Again, our number is 866-798-TALK. It's 866-798-8255. You can join the father of virtual reality, Jaron Lanier, here on Your Call. You can also send us an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org. So you actually, as you say, you're part of this whole industry. You were part of the original architecture of this industry in some ways. What are people who work at Google and Facebook, what are they saying to you? How are they responding to this?
Well, I'm going to talk at Google pretty soon, but I have a lot of, I mean, I an old startup of mine is part of Google, and I have tons of friends there and all. And, you know, I have to say, one of the nice things about the Silicon Valley elite is it's really the sweetest, most optimistic, and most pleasant elite you could ever hope for. I still think it's an unsustainable level of eliteness. I mean, when you have 13 people at Instagram, you know, creating a company that sells for $1 billion, I have nothing against those people, and I wish them all the success. But it is a kind of success that concentrates incredible wealth in a small number of people by shrinking the overall economy. Like, to say that all of the value from all these millions of people who use Instagram gets concentrated in these 13 people, or more recently, Tumblr and Yahoo. I think it's 100.
Tumblr was just acquired by Yahoo, I think, yesterday, right?
Yeah, and it's like 130 people, and I think that one was $1 billion.
$1 billion, yes.
And so what you have is these incredible concentrations in very small numbers of people who happen to be close to the biggest computers. And, you know, as we've said, you know, if it was only photography, society can absorb that. The problem is that the pattern will keep on continuing until we change it, because technology will keep on advancing, and it's not a way of doing things that we can afford to continue.
So you're saying that we journalists, musicians, photographers are essentially the canaries in the coal mine. This wasn't kind of an anomalous example of, oh, okay, these are the old industries, this is the agriculture of the turn of the last century. This is going to be a trend that we're going to see everywhere. Healthcare. We're going to basically see all of the jobs that we know right now go away.
Right. Well, you know, actually, the labor movement of a century ago is really worth recalling, because what happened was there was a wave of new technologies like cars and trucks, for example, that created new kinds of roles for people that were much easier and less dangerous and less just disgusting than the previous ones. It's just a lot easier to drive a truck than to deal with horses to move carriages around. And it required a really tough-fought labor battle in order to create jobs for people, even if the new jobs were more pleasant. That's one way of framing what the labor movement was all about. And so we created a kind of a covenant in the 20th century that even if the roles for people kind of got nicer when technology got nicer, they'd still deserve to get paid. So that's why they're Teamsters. That's why unions exist. And by the way, there were unions for Hollywood and for musicians. They've been terribly weakened, especially in the musical world. But that's why all that stuff came into being. What's happened now is we've decided once again, well, the roles for people are getting easier because machines are getting better. But this time around, you know what? This is too easy. People should only enjoy informal benefits. Just being able to promote yourself or find a couch to crash on easier, that's enough for you. You don't get paid. You don't get formal benefits. You don't get security. And that's not a world we can afford to enter.
So you're saying we need to have these new kind of social compacts, social contracts happening, the kind that we instituted in the early 19th century, mid-19th century.
Okay, so what the book is about is the possibility that we can accomplish something along the lines of what the union movements did in the early 20th century, but actually do something much better. So just as an example, if you look at if you look at a network like the one Apple runs to sell apps, or what Google runs for YouTube videos, only a tiny number of people do well in that, and almost everybody is a wannabe, lives on hope, but doesn't really succeed. But if you look at what happens on Facebook, what's really interesting is that most people on Facebook are interested in a fairly large number of people and not just a few winners. So, and it's a different kind of network where everybody's connected to everybody instead of everybody going through a central hub. And so what's really cool is if a network like Facebook were monetized, it would naturally create a middle class just out of what people are interested in.
So how would you propose monetizing that?
Well, of course, this is where it gets tricky. So my thought is to Facebook's only run by one person, so we could hypnotize him.
Mark?
Yeah.
Hey, Mark, if you're listening. Okay, so the answer, I would just like to clue everybody in, the answer is to hypnotize Mark Zuckerberg, and we can...
Well, no, actually, I mean that with a degree of seriousness. I do think that the Silicon Valley elite, at least, are pretty... decent and well-intended people, for the most part, really. I mean, and so there's an opening there. Now, when we talk about the Wall Street elite, they're...
Wait, but so what do you want Facebook to actually do to monetize this?
Well, okay. I mean, I'd like Facebook to try... I think they have to approach it gradually because it's very experimental, so I wouldn't want them to do this huge shift and then fail. But here's an example. 3D printers are about to come online. These are these things that kind of look like microwaves, and you download a design from the internet, and these little moving spigots deposit little bits of material until an object that you want is created as if by magic out of information. So these things are still pretty crude, but they'll get better and better, and eventually they'll replace a lot of factories, throwing even more people out of work. So when that happens, will it be like Napster, where the people who do the designs don't get paid? Maybe this time around we can play around with actually letting designers get paid. Let's just try it in something like that. And maybe Facebook could start a way to monetize 3D printer information. And then if that starts to generate a lot of wealth and successful careers, it generates more customers for Facebook and for Google and for everybody else. So we're not all stuck with only one stupid business model for the whole of the internet, which is advertising. You know, that, you know, we need to try experiments, and I think we have to grope towards it. We're not going to figure it all out at once, but we have to start trying. Affordable information is actually going to be more available and more democratic than absolutely free information, because absolutely free information doesn't constrain the overuse of the biggest computers. I mean,
let's okay. go to a call. No, this is great. Let's go to a caller. Let's go to Andrew in San Francisco. Hi, Andrew. Welcome to your call.
Thanks. So maybe this dovetails into what you're about to talk about, but yeah, locally, you hear more and more about this idea of big data, and I guess in some ways they may do themselves a disservice by calling it big data. But, you know, I was surprised to learn that Amazon, for example, is making a lot of money not off of distributing, you know, the stuff that they're selling online, but with the server farms that they have. So what does big data mean to us in general when... and maybe the future of big data when you have the likes of Amazon and I forget who else is in the business. But
let's answer off there. Thanks, Andrew. Let's get an answer. So, what do we mean when we say big data? And what
okay, well, when you say big data, there are actually two totally different kinds of things that are called big data. One is big data measured from nature, and that's like the data that allows us to be aware of global climate change, that allows us to do epidemiology, that allows us to understand our own biology. That's a crucial frontier of science without which we can't be competent. And there the problem is just learning how to deal with it well so people really believe it. And with global climate change, it's a great example where a lot of really smart people just can't believe it because they're not used to big data saying anything real.
And it's thanks to a lot of these digital networks that we can get that kind of
right.
big data.
Yeah, so if anybody thinks I'm anti-digital network, I hope this dispels that. I love technology. I love the internet.
And we're going to leave it there, and we'll continue with the big data question after we go to a short break. You're listening to Your Call. Our guest is Jaron Lanier, and his new book is Who Owns the Future? He's also the author of You Are Not a Gadget, and he's speaking to us this hour. You can join our conversation by calling 866-798-TALK. It's a toll-free number, 866-798-8255. I'm Holly Kernan. You're listening to Your Call. We'll be right back after this short break.
I'm Matt Martin here with Joe Burke, and in this two-minute break from Holly's conversation with Jaron Lanier, we're asking for your support on the last day of KALW's spring membership campaign, the last opportunity to say yes to your call, yes to local public radio, yes to interruption-free fundraising in just 7 days. We have a challenge from Patricia Yenowin in Bolinas and Anna's Daughter's Bakery in Sausalito, $1,000 challenge. If we get 25 calls or clicks during this hour, 25 people taking part, That's $1,000 additional dollars for KALW. Be the next person to take part. 800-525-9917. 800-525-9917.
Your call with Holly Kernan and Rose Aguilar is one of the best things we've done here at Local Public Radio in a long, long time. If you agree that it's worthy of your support, we'd love to hear from you this morning here on the 7th of our 7 days in May membership campaign. And again, as Matt mentioned, we have $1,000 on the line. All we need are a few calls, one at a time. That's how we'll do it. 800-525-9917 or online, KALW.org.
We have Jaron Lanier's book, Who Owns the Future? Yours for a $120 contribution. This is a fascinating book. It's been getting a lot of attention. New York Times, Atlantic, Harper's, other places. Your support at 800-525-9917, online at KALW.org. We'll keep this station strong, keep this program strong, and for a $120 contribution, we'll get you Jaron Lanier's new book.
800-525-9917. That's the number to call. You can also go to our website, KALW.org. Join us here on the last day of our spring membership campaign. If you agree that shorter is better, particularly when it comes to membership campaigns, we'd love to hear from you right now. 800-525-9917.
KALW.org. Help us make this spring campaign a success. We want to wrap it up at midnight, but we got to keep pushing toward our goal. 800-525-9917. Thank you.
Or online at KALW.org. Now back to Holly Kernan.
For those of you joining us now, I'm Holly Kernan, and this is Your Call. We're podcasting our show. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. Tomorrow, we'll talk about strikes. Are they effective in today's labor climate? UCSF patient care workers are striking. The concession union workers at the Giants AT&T Park voted to authorize a strike, and San Francisco Symphony workers have just come out of negotiations after their own strike. So what makes a successful strike, and what strategies are actually helping workers organize? Friday is our weekly media roundtable. We'll talk with journalists about the coverage of the week's news. Today, we're asking, what is the cost of making information free? Our guest is Jaron Lanier, author of Who Owns the Future? As digital technologies and social media networks get smarter, faster, larger, and more comprehensive, Lanier says the people who are making the networks valuable in the first place are the ones who are losing out. So what would happen if we were paid for our contributions to Facebook or Instagram, for example, or for our data? How can we shift the wealth of the information economy from the few to the many? We have almost full lines, but I'm going to give out the number one more time. It's 866-798-TALK. It's a toll-free number, 866-798-8255. If the lines are full, you can send us an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org. And Jaron, right before we went to the break, Andrew had asked a question about big data to see if you could explain it. You gave us the first part, which is the epidemiological use of big data to understand climate change, et cetera, and then you were going to tell us.
Right, but then big data is conflated to also mean this other thing entirely, which is people in disguise. So when big data really means contributions from people who are made anonymous so that their efforts can be resold or given away as treats to get people into some sort of giant spying scheme online, that's a different kind of big data, and we shouldn't really use the same terminology for both of them. So
let's coin a new phrase, father of virtual reality.
I call it big human data versus big natural data in the book, which is maybe not the most...
All right, so let me ask about big human data. So surveillance right now is ubiquitous, what you call, you know, everybody's spying on us nowadays.
Yeah.
Can you just explain that for people? I mean, how are people taking our data for free right now?
Well,
and is that different than in other places?
You mean America versus the world?
Yeah, the whole opt-in, opt-out.
There are slight differences around the world, but it's mostly the same. There are a ton of big computers that are creating secret dossiers on you. So, you know, the idea that all the information is freely available is a complete illusion, because the most important information that will really influence your life is totally hidden from you. So when you operate on a social network like Facebook, you can see a certain level of information where you can tend how you look to the world and try to look popular, whatever it is you want to do. But it deep in the guts, deep in the dungeon of the biggest computers, there are these models of you, predictive models, which don't necessarily predict each and every one of us all the time reliably, but statistically, overall, they get good because that's just what statistics is for. You know, it's just math. And so it predicts exactly which options can be put in front of you, which links or other options that you're likely to act on. And by doing that, it can gradually influence you. And it's always in some way that you and everybody else take on a little more risk and a little more cost and a little bit of loss opportunity, just incrementally, a little bit at a time, while the big computer gets a little bit more benefit, a little less risk incrementally over time, gradually creating an inequity. And this happens in a lot of different ways, depending on which big computer it is.
Can you give us a concrete example of how this happens?
Yeah, sure. So one simple way is you get your music for free, but if you're a musician, your prospects for wealth, you can still self-promote, you can still get informal benefits, but your prospects for really building a career that you could raise kids on and grow old on are diminished. You get a cheap, easy mortgage, a little treat in advance. You remember how mortgages were so easy and cheap at a certain point not too long ago? But then everybody suffers a lowered credit access and increased risk because the specific mechanism is that thing I was talking about before. And I know this is just a little technical, but it's the idea of trying to open that Maxwell's demon thing where you're trying to create a perfect scheme where you put the risk on everybody else, on the ordinary people, and you yourself try to create a perfect business. When it comes to the government, it's really interesting. So in the past, governments were constrained by a mixture of different elements. On the one hand, of course, we have laws to try to constrain government, but we also had budgets. The idea is that the people somehow pay either voluntary taxes they vote on themselves or tributes that are forced, but whatever, the government still has to pay to buy its own police cars and pay its police and whatever it is. But with the advent of free information, for the first time, the government doesn't have to pay. And this is an extraordinary thing, and this is maybe one of the worst failures in the ideology of free information, and one of the reasons why I think it's really backfired and is backfiring. So wars were fought to try to prevent regimes from becoming powerful that wanted to spy on every person and track everybody. And yet now that's doable for free. When there are cameras at every corner in major cities and software that can track individuals walking around. And I've contributed to such software, by the way. So once again, I'm totally part of this world. I'm not some alien critic looking from afar. But when you can do that, all of a sudden, you're creating for the government's big computer, playing exactly the same game I've talked about, this ability to know where everybody is and to make little decisions to optimize from some weird point of view, whatever it is at the time. Now, if the government had to pay people when they're recognized, in other words, if you were owed money anytime somebody was able to make use of bits that only exist because you exist, at least there would be that additional layer of budgetary constraint that's always been a necessary part of restraining governments in the past. Now, I'm not saying we don't also need lawyers and laws and advocacy groups and all that, but if we're saying that it costs nothing to spy on people, then there'll be infinite spying, you know, and that's the thing we have to avoid.
And you're listening to Your Call. I'm Holly Kernan. Our guest is Jaron Lanier. His book is Who Owns the Future? And we have a lot of callers on the line, so I want to get to a number of them. Let's go to Douglas in Santa Cruz. Hi, welcome to Your Call, Douglas.
Good morning. Thank you for taking the call.
Absolutely.
My question is, if these large information systems are going to create a class divide and create joblessness or unemployment, how is it that the classes on top expect to make money, cash, or survive if we, the worker bees, aren't feeding them through that cash? And if that's the question or the case, do you see our monetary system actually changing, or our currency specifically? And I'll take my answer off there. Thank you.
Thanks, Douglas. Yeah, he writes about this extensively in the book.
Yeah. I mean, this this is something that industrialists and financiers have realized for a long time. I mean, Henry Ford, who was an absolute racist creep, don't get me wrong, but one thing that he realized just as a matter of practicality is that his own factory workers had to be able to afford the cars they were making or the whole scheme would fail. So this is something that people used to know. I think what's happened is we've gotten kind of soft and forgetful, and there's, like, you don't know how amazing it feels to be on top of one of the biggest computers. Like at that moment when you're running a giant computer and you have this visibility into the world that nobody else has, and you can make little manipulations for your own benefit and accumulate.
You're like a deity.
It's weird. It is almost like you have a god's eye view. And I've been part of this process a few times in different ways. It's so thrilling. It's so amazing that I think you lose perspective, and you do get this feeling that you can create the infinitely perfect business that'll just create this giant profit and that there won't be any cost and no risk. And of course, that's a complete illusion, but it's incredibly seductive when it happens.
Well, and like you say, most of the people working at these companies are well-meaning, frequently very altruistic, and have a lot of visions of what society will be. And in fact, you say that we've kind of all bought into this big lie that the end of all of this digital revolution is going to be a utopian society. But if we don't work to actually make sure that we're creating the architecture that will get us there, that's not going to happen.
Well, it was a big mistake, not a big lie, because I really believe that we came into this innocently, or at least I saw it happening. And now some of the folks in finance are not so innocent, because maybe some of the early people, like maybe long-term capital, got into it innocently. I think that's possible, actually. At the time, I think it was true, in fact. But Enron was not innocent. By that time, they knew. And by the time the recent scandals related to bundling mortgages came about, they definitely knew. So the innocence can't be claimed in that sector. But I think Silicon Valley really entered it not only with good intentions, but spectacular intentions. I mean, if you look at something like Craigslist, which, you know, Craig Newmark could have built some giant empire and just chose to be modest and really wants to help the world. I mean, he's a genuinely good guy. And yet it still defunds the local press. It still centralizes.
But isn't that just the nature of the evolution of economies and societies?
I mean,
it gets to that whole question of gentrification versus changing neighborhoods, changing demographics.
So long as there's a covenant that in the new roles, people are still valuable. So, yes, the buggy whip industry should have gone down, but the correlate of that is that Teamsters should still get paid, right?
And but you may not have any blacksmiths, right?
Right. And the correlate of that is electricians should still get paid. In other words, as human roles shift because of technology and shift for the better in most cases, they become more dignified, more creative, safer, more pleasant, and all that. You have to continue the decision that people are worth paying even if the jobs aren't miserable. If you don't maintain that covenant, that's where the problem is. The idea of technological improvement is fantastic. It leads to better, healthier lives. I mean, if you look at the past, the further back you go, the more miserable people were in general, with some, you know, with some notable potholes along the way, like wars and genocides and slavery and blah, blah, blah. But overall, you know, the farther back you go, the more infant mortality there is, the shorter lifespans are, the more disease there is. We've really improved our lot through technology. It's a good thing. We just have to continue to value each other even when our machines are good. That's the issue.
And getting to what Douglas was bringing up, you make the point in your book that feudal economies aren't even good for the people in power ultimately, because if you have this big bump of people who can spend money and keep the economy thriving, that's even good for the wealthy, right?
Right. And that's why traditional revolutions are possible, because the kind of power that people have when it's really just them and their family and everybody else is beholden to them is very weak, and they're toppleable. But you know, some of my lefty friends actually kind of relish what's going on. They're saying, great, new elite, we can topple it. But, you know, what I'd rather do is talk about these issues and come up with a better solution intentionally instead of through some sort of a shock revolution and when the machines get really good.
Which you say puts people at the centerpiece of this new economy, of these new technologies. Mm-hmm. We're speaking with Jaron Lanier. He's the author of Who Owns the Future? You're listening to Your Call. I'm Holly Kernan. I want to get to more of your calls. We have a lot of people on the line. But let me give out the number one more time and invite people to share in this conversation with Jaron Lanier. 866-798-TALK. The number again is 866-798-8255. And if you work in the digital industries, we'd really love to hear what you think of what Jaron Lanier is saying about the need to strengthen the so-called middle class, or the people who are at the center of this digital revolution, whose data is actually being mined and used to create these new systems. 866-798-8255. And do you think you should be compensated for the information that you share through online social networks? If you're somebody who uses Facebook, Twitter, Twitter, et cetera. How are you using it? How does it enhance your life? And do you think you should somehow be paid or be paying for the information that you're getting and receiving? 866 and giving and receiving, 866-798-TALK. Toll-free number again is 866-798-8255. Let's go to Lawrence in Berkeley. Hi, Lawrence.
Hi, good morning, Holly. Good morning, Jaron.
Hey.
With all due respect, I don't think the problem is computers that we have now. And I want to give an analysis and a solution. In the 30s, we didn't have any computers, and the level of unemployment was vastly more than it is now, and the middle class was a whole lot smaller. And in 1819, you know, when power looms were replacing home weavers, that's when we had the Luddites that were breaking those looms, it was also the same. There was hardly any middle class and huge unemployment. The problem is that whatever the technology, the capitalists, the people who own it, get all the benefits from it, and the rest of us either get unemployed or we have to work harder. And that's true whether we're making cars or computers or weaving cloth. And I wanted to, you know, as a solution, I wanted to say that the traditional argument is between corporations and government. You know, but the government would have money. There's a third level that people don't consider, and that's the community or the civic level. And that is the people who are helping each other in their neighborhoods. They're helping growing food in each other's yards. They're teaching each other. They're doing each other's carpentry. And eventually, they should be the community, the local community should take over all of the McDonald's and all of the little stores and run them as community co-ops. And the money there can cut, you know. The point is that every time there's an invention, whether it's cars or computers or looms, the money from that invention and the money from that work should go to the community, we should all have a guaranteed income, but not to do nothing. We should have a guaranteed income from these inventions.
So, Lawrence, just in the interest of time, do you have a specific question for Jared?
Well, yeah, the thing is that he says we should value each other. Well, we have to value each other in terms of the people whom we know personally. That means the neighbors, the neighborhood. And the whole problem would be solved if the money from these industries goes to the community, which will then employ people to help each other.
Okay, thank you. Go ahead.
Okay, well, you know, in the Silicon Valley circuit, the idea of promoting volunteerism and sort of civic informal economy stuff is extremely popular. And like my buddy Stuart Brand for a while was giving talks about how great it is that people do this sort of stuff in the slums of Rio. And the thing is that from the perspective of running one of the big computers, if you can get people to do what you're suggesting, it's great for us because then they get by with the informal benefits and we still concentrate the wealth. You're falling into a trap, in my view. I totally get it. I understand the appeal of it. The problem is that informal benefits are just not reliable. There are a lot of reasons for that. One of them is just that people are ornery. I've worked really hard in all kinds of collective situations. I've worked with food co-ops. I've worked with farm co-ops. I've done a lot of it. I've lived in cooperative households. And anybody who's done that knows it's hard to plan a life on it. Just people are really tricky. It's one thing to do it for a while. It's one thing to do it with a very small number of very special people who've worked it out. It's another thing to do it generally, universally. It's just we're not easy enough with each other for it. That's one problem. And I also just got to say, there were computers back then. They were not physical computers. The term computer meant a woman, usually a young woman, who was employed to calculate by hand, usually at a very long table with a bunch of other young women in long buildings in upstate New York. And the schemes that led up to earlier financial failures were kind of like low amperage versions of our current ones. And the solution was the labor movement. The solution was the covenant that people can be paid. And when you say paying people for nothing, I strongly object. That's a terrible devaluation of people. Shame on you for saying that.
All right, let's go. We've got a lot of people who want to talk to you. I want to get back-to-back calls. Let's go first to Andy in Redwood City. Hi, welcome to your call, Andy. Andy, are you with us?
Hi, Holly. How you doing?
Hi, fine. We don't have too much time, so if you could be as brief as possible, that'd
all right.
be great.
Mr. Jared Lanier, you know, you sound like an infomercial for the Chamber of Commerce of Silicon Valley. If you think Wall Street is as ruthless, is more ruthless than Silicon Valley, I think you're crazy. I really do. Look at Larry Ellison back in the tech bubble with his stock options and his political contributions. Look at Apple with the Foxconn abuse and the tax havens that they have in Ireland and Liechtenstein and all over the Cayman Islands. Look at Mark Zuckerberg. He's just funding this U.S. forward. All he wants is more H-1Bs. He's doing commercials for the most right-wing politicians on the earth, like Lindsey Graham.
Andy.
Anwar, drilling.
Andy. Look, I actually have a lot of sympathy for what you've said, and you've listed a lot of the little issues that are annoying me the most about my beloved Silicon Valley community. So I kind of think you're right.
But what you seem to be saying, Jared, is that potentially there is a place that there's a space for dialogue.
Yeah, you know, I it's comparative. I mean, let me say, as annoyed as you might be with aspects of Silicon Valley, and I think you really hit a lot of the ones that annoy me personally a great deal, although I disagree with you about the visas, but everything else I'm with you on. I got to say, it gets worse. You might not believe it, but you should go visit Wall Street. You wouldn't, I mean, Mike, yeah, it actually does get worse.
All right, we're gonna move on here just because there's so many people who want to talk to you. Let's go to Jory in Berkeley. Hi, Jory. Welcome to your call.
Hi. I just want to say I agree with us very much of what you said, almost everything. The only thing I question is your example about how to reimburse the people. And I realize that you mentioned it as a baby step. But what are some of the more significant steps other than paying people who are smart enough and talented enough to design some kind of device that someone would want to print on a 3D printer?
All right. Okay. We're getting to solutions. Thank you, Jory.
Yeah. So this gets to this. All right. I run into this all the time. People tell me, but only a tiny number of people really contribute anything. And I just got to tell you, every observation, all the empirical data that I've seen about humans contradicts that. I think vast numbers of people contribute a lot. It's just that we undervalue them. I think there's a myth of an elite that we have to overcome. You can see that in the math of how people connect to each other on social networks when they have a chance to, where a lot of people find a lot of value in a lot of other people instead of just in a tiny number. As far as the designs of 3D stuff, there's all kinds of brilliance. I mean, I have friends who make a fortune being cool hunters, where they go into poor neighborhoods to pick up on fashions that poor kids come up with and then resell them for tons of money.
Cool hunters.
Cool hunters. It's a profession, yeah. And, you know, like right now, it's not that there aren't a lot of people who offer a lot of value. Instead, that there are only a few people who we acknowledge as offering value, and our idea of what value is very narrow. But if we look at what people are actually interested online when they have a chance to do it, we see something much broader. So it's just, you know, I just have real faith in the broad value of humanity, and I just think you're wrong and too pessimistic about what people offer.
And Jackie writes, we got an email, she says, be careful. Remember that there were unintended consequences for ideas before. With income and power so radically skewed as it is now, how would starting to charge for info not hurt the already disadvantaged? I think you have to have high taxes at the top in order to make change, not just tinkering. That's from Jackie. And let's go to Bernard. You're going to be our last call. Bernard, welcome to your call. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I've been documenting what entrepreneurs do in a virtual world called Second Life, and it's quite amazing. There are thousands of people who make money with virtual goods and services. Now, granted, some of this stuff is maybe pocket money, but some people actually make a living, you know, making animation, selling it to other users. So, Jaron, if I could get your take on it, if something like Second Life would be broadly available to everybody from a smaller machine, and they could participate in the digital goods economy. In Second Life alone, it's about 500, 600 million US dollars user-to-user transactions, and some of these people who make things you know, they don't have any formal training. They're essentially self-taught. So this is, I think, a fascinating phenomenon that we really have to watch. I'm not saying that it will bring back the middle class, but it's a way to, it's a completely new marketplace.
Yeah, so I'm a little biased on Second Life because I've been an advisor to it from the start, and it was definitely an experiment in this sort of thing. And in my view, it's not a perfect experiment. I strongly agree with the earlier caller who said that we should be careful about unintended consequences. I think we have to be experimental and incremental. Big ideas usually do backfire. The free information idea was one example. I don't want to repeat that general pattern of having some huge, supposedly perfect idea that ends up screwing everybody. I think instead we need to do a lot of little experiments like Second Life and recognize that none of them are perfect and learn lessons and approach it incrementally and learn. You know, that's what people should be good at. And so that's what I'm advocating here. That's how we got the internet working in the first place. That's how we need to improve it.
And we just have about a minute left before we finish our show here. So, Jaron, maybe you could give us a few tips on what you'd like listeners to take away from this. And Ken asks, should we stop giving out our phone number when people ask for that online? Like, should we stop giving out our data for free? What kinds of practical tips do you have for people?
Well, one thing I'd start doing is just keep an account of the difference between what you pay for groceries when you use your club card or when you don't, and the difference in your travel when you're part of a frequent flyer thing and when you're not, and all that kind of stuff. And you'll start to see in that difference how much money you should actually be owed as cash that you can spend as you wish. And I think you'll start to see a degree of inequity in the current system, and I think more people will start to see it, and then it'll gradually change.
And in our remaining few seconds, I'm going to ask you to play this lovely instrument that you have brought. It's the Khan from Laos.
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about it before you start playing.
Oh, it's an ancient mouth organ design, and I just adore them. It's there's a whole culture of mouth organs all over Southeast Asia.
Let's hear it.
Okay,
we're
going to
hear Jaron Lanier, who, in addition to being a futurist and expert in digital technology, is also an expert with musical instruments, and he has hundreds of them. We're going to have to leave it there. Go ahead, Jaron. We've been speaking with Jaron Lanier, who's a scientist, musician, virtual technology pioneer, and he is the author of You Are Not a Gadget and the new Who Owns the Future. I want to thank everybody who called us. I'm sorry we couldn't get to all of them. I'm Holly Kernan, and you're listening to Your Call.
And you are listening to Your Call on KALW. I'm Matt Martin, joining Holly and Jaron here in the studio. Thank you so much,
Jaron. Thanks, Jaron.
We love music as part of the mix, as well as news and information here on KALW. And on this last day of our spring membership campaign, it's great to have Jaron, who's a friend and supporter of the station.
And he's local.
Here in the studio with
in
us.
In the house, Jaron.
As we ask for your support, we have a challenge in front of us in this hour,
okay,
which is $1,000 put up by Patricia Yenowin and Anna Daughters Bakery in Sausalito.
Oh, they thanks, Patricia.
If 25 people will support KALW during this hour, they will put that additional $1,000 forward. We are down to $62,000 to go.
Wow, that's great.
End this membership campaign tonight. Your support will make it possible.
This is our last day of our Shorter is Better drive. The number is 800-525-9917. We just have a few seconds to get those phones ringing off the hook to support programs like Your Call, local independent radio, voices that are controversial and that thought-provoking, like Jaron Lanier. You can actually get this book, Who Owns the Future, for a contribution of what?
$120
or above. 800-525-9917 or KALW.org. We do this one person at a time, Matt.
800-525-9917, KALW.org. We do not harvest and monetize your data. We keep everything private right here KALW. You have a relationship with your local public radio station. That's where it should stay. But we do ask for your support on a voluntary basis, because if you think this is valuable and you understand that a non-commercial listener-supported radio station simply sounds different, simply serves the community differently, your support now at 800-525-9917 will keep this model strong.
1-800-525-9917. Hundreds and hundreds of people are responding to the Shorter is Better Treat You Like an Adult campaign to say, you know how this works. We don't need to take out minutes and minutes and minutes away from every program to tell you that you appreciate independent, local, responsive public radio. And we have an incentive for you right now. You can get Jaron Lanier's excellent book, Who Owns the Future? It is so provocative. It is so informative. I read it most of it last night. I couldn't sleep. It was so good. You can get that for a contribution of $120 or above and be part of our historic Shorter is Better campaign, KALW.org or 800-525-9917. I see an open line, Matt.
800-525-9917. If we reach this goal of 25 calls, that's an additional $1,000 for KALW. A click is as good as a call at KALW.org. Who Owns the Future? Jaron Lanier's new book, yours for a $120 contribution. But most importantly, you will take part on this day where we're going to say, yes, we can make this different approach work. Yes, we can keep community-based, non-commercial radio strong here in the Bay Area. This community has a commitment to that. And if you feel that commitment, join all the folks that have done it today. 800-525-9917.
This is your last chance to stand up for your call. I hear from people all the time. I love Rose Aguilar. We love her too. Here's where you show your support for Rose and the great work that she and the team do every day. KALW.org. We need just 25 people and we've got about 30 seconds to do it, Matt. I know we can do it because listeners respond. 800-525-9917. And while you're there, get a copy of Jaron Lanier's Who Owns the Future. It's a great gift. It's a great read. 525-9917. It's a toll-free number. 800-525-9917. You can continue to go to KALW.org and become a member right now.
We are going to be going to the news headlines from the BBC in just a moment here on KALW San Francisco. Thank you to everyone who has taken part. Please, 800-525-9917.